This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. National concerns about the so-called crisis in higher education resonate strongly here in the Granite State. New Hampshire college students have the country's largest debt levels, while the state's contribution to its public higher ed system is the smallest. The good news is that colleges and universities here have begun innovating like their counterparts elsewhere, especially on the number one issue, cost, so that more Granite Staters can afford to get that college degree. But in a new book, our guest today, longtime higher education writer Goldie Blumenstick, warns that while some of these changes will help students, others may be less welcome, including what she calls the commodification of college learning. Today in The Exchange, chronicle of higher education reporter and author Goldie Blumenstick on her new book, American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. Let's hear from you, your questions or observations about what you see happening in American higher ed, especially here in the Granite State. Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Goldie Blumenstick joins us from D.C. And Goldie, it's great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, just a few decades ago, Goldie, a college education was affordable, not for everybody, but for many, considered a ticket to future success. Now it is not so affordable, and a lot of Americans are questioning the whole value of higher education. How do we get here?
It's a complicated tale, but I'll try to break it down for you a little bit. It sort of starts with the colleges themselves. The college costs have gone up quite a lot over the years. As we all know, college is it's not an easy thing to sort of industrialize or mechanize. It's somewhat of an artisanal industry. You know, it's a lot of faculty time and a lot of expensive people who work at colleges, and so those costs tend to go up a lot higher than a lot of other costs in our society. At the same time, colleges have been building more facilities and trying to compete more to get students, and some of those things drive up the costs. We've also had this other phenomenon in our economy, frankly, for the last 20 years, where basically family income, you know, except for the very wealthy, family incomes have remained flat. So at some level, college costs have been going up a great deal, and compare that with the family incomes that have not been rising at all. That's a very, very uncomfortable mix for families when you're trying to pay for college.
Yeah, and there's a chart on that in your book, and it is pretty striking. Yes, college has gone up a lot, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but family incomes, their ability to pay, have not. So there's a big gap there. Here's the eternal question, though, Goldie, and we're hitting it right on the head. We've talked about this, you know, more than 100 times probably on this program. Why is it so expensive? And I just want to give folks a sense of some of the numbers you have in the book. You write that the price of college over the past 25 years has gone up 538% compared to 121% increase in inflation. People have a really hard time getting their heads around this, Goldie, that college could go up so much more than everything else.
I know. And, you know, I shouldn't even confess this, I guess. But I've been covering higher education for 26 years now for the Chronicle. And if you ask me why does college cost so much, I can't give you a single answer.
Right.
It's just not that easy. Administrative costs go up. Colleges hire a lot. Colleges are places with a lot of complex operations, IT, research, a lot of regulations that they have to adhere to. So there's a lot of hiring of administrators. That's increased a lot faster than the hiring of faculty members. Their facilities are not always that affordable. You know, they need to build science facilities and research facilities. Those kinds of facilities are expensive. Frankly, in some cases, there's subsidies for athletics that kind of go unrecognized, and that also drives up costs quite a bit. So you know, sort of everywhere you look, there's like a lot of costs that go up faster than they do in a lot of other industries.
Well, it's interesting, and I've heard this before, and yet, you know, okay, I'm hearkening back to my own college education a quarter century ago. There were administrators back then. We all remember the registrar's office, the bursar's office. There were football teams and basketball teams. There was a reasonable dining hall. So there's always been those components to the cost. I just wonder why so much now, why it's so much higher.
Well, there is more red tape going on before it. More red tape and more regulation than there were before. I don't think there were FERPA laws when we were in school, or to the extent that there were right now. That's the student privacy laws. A lot of the Title IX regulations, the things about equity in athletics and equity in actually accommodation, weren't in effect. You know, when I was in school, we had to go to the computer center to do our computer to take our computer class. And now, you know, there's an IT infrastructure all over campus, and that's supposed to save us time and money. And in fact, it costs a lot of money also to maintain. I'm not trying to excuse it. The nature of industries, the nature of the college experience has changed quite a bit from when we were there. You know, frankly, even the dining hall is probably a lot nicer than what you and I remember.
I remember a shared phone. We had a phone in between the wall, and, you know, we had to share it with the girls on the other side of the wall. I'm guessing that's not the case anymore.
There's probably not even that many phones anymore, because that whole flow of getting phone in your dorm and then out of your dorm is probably gone. Everyone's on the cell phone. But, you know, you need to maintain a wireless infrastructure across your whole campus. You need to have servers. Students take their classes, even if they're not taking a class online, they have their course stuff is online, and all that stuff just takes, you know, it's supposed to save money, but it actually costs a lot of money, too, to keep that infrastructure running.
Well, here's another reason that we've sometimes talked about on this program, about another reason behind the increasing cost, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Goldie. Some people say increased student loans, increased student aid. You know, a lot of schools like to tout that, hey, if you can't afford it, we've got a financial aid package for you. But some people say that's kind of like easy mortgage lending. It encourages people to buy too much house. What do you think? Does too much student aid and loans and so forth encourage schools to raise the sticker price? Because, you know, most kids aren't going to pay it anyway.
There's a giant national debate about that whole issue. It even has a name. They call it the Bennett hypothesis. That's named after the former Secretary of Education, Bill Bennett, who used to make exactly that argument, that the availability of federal student aid, and he would say the availability of federal student loans, allows colleges to, in effect, raise their prices because they know students can get the money. It's been very contested whether or not that's, in fact, a theory or not. I think no one would argue that there's an element of that in the whole pricing dynamic for colleges right now. Whether that's the only reason that this aid goes up, I think it's also hard to say, because there are real factors. I mean, more likely it's the college, to some degree, it's some of the things I describe myself. And, I mean, colleges are places that are ambitious places. They like to have the best X and the most major and the best facilities, and they're competitive. And in some cases that makes them great, and in some cases it makes them kind of silly. They compete with things like on who has the best fitness center as opposed to who has the best, environmental engineering program or something.
Well, a couple more questions on cost, Goldie, but I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The exchange number here is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest today is Goldie Blumenstick. She's been writing for a long time for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's got a new book out. It's called American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. What do you think about this cost issue that we're digging into right now with Goldie? Why do you think college costs so much? What might help reduce the costs? 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Goldie, following up exactly on that point you just made, colleges competing to offer the nicest or the best, why don't they compete on cost by offering lower tuition? I mean, people don't mind shopping for bargains when it comes to, you know, pants or socks or shoes.
Well, I think that's starting to change, and that some colleges will start competing a little bit more on cost. You're seeing lately a lot more ratings coming out from mainstream magazines about the best value for college. And I think that dynamic is starting to change. There's also been, I think, a lot more attention in the last couple of years for people willing to, you know, spend the first 2 years at a community college to save the money. I think students and their families are starting to recognize that they can get a very good education without having to pay top dollar for it in some cases. And I imagine some of that's going to change even further. The Obama administration has been making a lot of efforts to try to increase sort of transparency on college costs with some of these college scorecards and the requirement that colleges post something called a net price calculator on their website. Right now, you have every college is supposed to have this thing on their website where you can punch in your family income and the college costs and get a sense of what the college is going to cost you, you know, given your particular circumstances. So I do think you're starting to see a lot more attention to the cost of college and from the colleges themselves.
Yeah, and this gets into the whole bigger topic that you talk about in the book, Goldie, about value. And there's so much emphasis on, you know, getting a good value. And a little bit later, we'll talk about, you know, there's some concerns that come up, too. College education becomes a commodity and so forth. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you want, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number to join us this morning. One more cost question, Goldie, and then we'll move into that whole value issue that you write about. You talk about the decline in state funding in many states, and of course, this is a big deal in New Hampshire. How much is that contributing to the rise in college costs?
It's contributing a great deal to the rise in college prices. I try to make that distinction in the book. What it costs to provide the education is sort of its own calculus. But then who pays the share of that? That's what's affected by the changes in state support. If your state's providing less of the money, the student is providing more of the money. And over the past 20 years, a lot of states have been cutting back on a per student basis of what they provide for students, what they provide towards the cost. And that means families and students are having to pick up the difference. And I looked at New Hampshire, and obviously that's a very big issue in New Hampshire right now.
What sort of philosophical shift does that represent, not just here in New Hampshire, but around the country?
Well, there's people who would argue that this generation probably giving up on the generation that comes behind it. That's a very sort of a dire look at it. There are others will say it's not necessarily philosophical, that there are other competing costs in state budgets. Medicaid costs, corrections costs, some of those things are not discretionary, and higher education is always discretionary in a state budget, in part because lawmakers know that the colleges can always increase tuition. They have a sort of a valve at the other end to bring in the money, and so higher education often has a hard time making its case in the legislature compared to some of these other things where you don't charge poor people for the Medicaid care, so. But there is a feeling that at some level that this generation has, our generation, frankly, has kind of abandoned the generation that's coming behind it.
All right. We will talk more after a very short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour in The Exchange, we're talking with author Goldie Blumenstick about her new book on the so-called crisis in American higher education. Blumenstick says, given rising costs, student debt, doubts about the value of that degree, crisis is a fair description, but she also sees some exciting examples of campus innovations that could help us get out of our college conundrum. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Goldie, let's go to our listeners. And Cole's in North Conway. Hi, Cole. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
A couple of quick questions. I'm just wondering, number one, why the preponderance of money these days seems to be going to infrastructure rather than going into classrooms, where it seems to be needed based on the fact that on a world level, our value of our education seems to be downgrading.
And when you say in the classroom, you don't mean the building itself, Cole. You mean the teachers, the professors.
I went to college a lot of years ago, but I had actual professors who were teaching the courses rather than TAs and rather than survey classes with 300 or 400 people, which is more than one today, particularly in undergraduate class.
Yeah, Cole, this is a huge issue. Thank you for raising it. The adjunctification. You write about this, Goldie, of higher education these days.
Yeah, it's a major change that's occurred in higher education over maybe the last 30 or 40 years, and probably increasingly so in the last 10. It used to be that professors who were sort of on the track at the university do get tenure or were tenured. They made up about, 40% of the faculty. And now it's much more like 25%. And there are a lot more so-called adjunct professors now who teach courses at colleges. I think colleges think that they can use these adjunct professors to save money because they only pay them, in some cases, $3,000 or so per course, and that's and often no health benefits. Most often, no health benefits or any other kind of benefits. And it's kind of like outsourcing in the rest of the economy. Colleges are sort of using that as a technique to, in effect, save money. I think there's a little back and forth on whether that actually does save money, because things that professors used to do, like advising students or sort of serving on committees and helping to sort of contribute to the governance of the university, is now having to be done by other people. So at the same time that they're saving money on instruction in one side, they're having to pay for advisors and other kinds of people to pick up some of these tasks on the other end. It's a little unclear why this approach has taken off, but it's it's one of the bigger changes that's occurred in higher education over the last, 25 years or so.
Yeah, and people hear about, this, and they get very frustrated because the colleges say, well, we're doing it to save money to keep the costs down, but the costs aren't going down. So
right.
It's almost like, why bother, right?
I agree with you. I don't really understand why this seems to be why this seems to be the approach that colleges are taking. Well, to one degree, I do know, because I think they see, as with the adjuncts, it gives them a little bit more flexibility. They can because with full-time professors who are in a tenured or tenure track position, it's a little harder to sort of adjust for changing student needs. If there's more demand for French, they can add more French professors, but in fact, there's probably less demand for French, so they don't have to have as big a French department, and they're not as responsible for these faculty members if they're only on sort of these part-time, just-in-time kind of professors that they hire. They can move them around and hire who they need and not hire who they don't need.
I see, like just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah, it's a little bit more of it gives the administration a little bit more flexibility in how they manage things, given changing markets for students.
All right. Well, Cole, it's a great question. Thank you for calling in. If you're on campus as an administrator, as an educator, as a student, if you're the parent of a student in college right now, we'd love to hear from you. Your questions, comments, concerns about both the cost and the attention these days on the value of a college education. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Okay, so Goldie, before we go back to our listeners, I do want to ask you about this question, value, because it's different from, cost and price. What are people talking about these days when they question the value of a degree?
Mostly what they're talking about is, will I get a job when I graduate? That's, like 88% of the freshmen who now go to college, they say that's their number one reason for going to college. And that's up from up considerably from the last several years. People now look at college as the place to go get their ticket punched to get a job. And in fact, they're not wrong, because so much has happened in our economy right now. People have an expectation that you're going to have some kind of college degree, maybe an associate's degree or maybe a bachelor's degree, to get hired for a job. It's become a much more important credential in the job market right now. So they're looking. That's the number one thing. And there's actually organizations out there right now that are looking to measure colleges based on the salaries of their graduates. Some people find that horrifying, but it's a trend that many states are starting to look at. Florida, Texas are starting to publish information on that. And there's even discussion that with a new college rating system that the Obama administration is talking about putting out soon, that they might also be including at least information on what salaries of graduates are, giving people that kind of information to determine where to go to school.
I don't know how you can get a number that makes sense looking at that, Goldie. I wonder what you think when one person might study engineering and another person might want to go into the field of, substance abuse treatment, which is also a big need, here in the state. So, how do you even look at a college and say, this is where I should go, when maybe a lot of people from that college become teachers or, counselors or so forth?
Well, that's exactly the reason that a lot of colleges and a lot of other people who are not at colleges are, in effect, almost horrified by this approach because they say you can't really make these kinds of comparisons. But I guess if you want to be a substance abuse counselor, you're not necessarily doing that for the money, but you certainly want to make a living at it. You could look at schools and figure out which schools are better for that than others. But those numbers are a complicated set of numbers. It depends on where you are and, what's the prevailing wages in your state, So it is a very complicated set of metrics, and I think that there are reasons that people out there really oppose them. On the other hand, the people who are pushing them say, you know, if we this is the kind of information people deserve to know, it shouldn't be the only piece of information that they use to pick a college, but it should be part of the decision-making process.
Well, and you do hear about, you know, bright, well-educated young people, you know, I hate to use a cliche, but flipping burgers, you know, not using that degree. So we do hear those stories, and people are horrified by those stories as well.
You know, we do hear the stories, but I think it's still important to note that even right now, the unemployment rate for people who don't have a college degree is twice as high as it is for those who do have a college degree. So there are those stories about students, you know, baristas and flipping burgers and the like, but for the most part, the students with the degrees are doing better in our economy than those who don't have one.
Let's go back to our listeners, Goalie. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Lots of people wanting to jump in on this conversation. Let's go to Gregory in West Lebanon. Hi, Gregory. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I'm wondering if your guest could comment on the exorbitant spending that's going on in higher education. Trustees are paying college presidents and other administrators hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are some presidents that are being paid over $1 million to administrate a college. And the administrative staff is growing leaps and bounds. There are assistants to assistants to assistants to do a job that 30 years ago one person would do.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling in, Gregory. You know, two points that he raises, Goldie, and the first one is interesting. He talks about trustees approving, you know, what he calls exorbitant salaries for people, especially college presidents. What role do college trustees play in keeping costs down, keeping an eye on this?
It's a great question, Gregory. I appreciate that. You know, it sounds like you may have read the Chronicle of Higher Education today. We have our annual report out today on the salaries of college presidents, and 36 presidents in the last period studied were making over $1 million a year.
Wow.
For private colleges. The role of trustees, it's an important role, and there's a lot of concern right now that trustees are not doing a good enough job in managing their institutions. There's questions about, you know, in some cases they're micromanaging in places where they shouldn't be. But in matters of spending, in matters of, like, salaries of the top leaders, in matters of really just sort of overlooking overall administrative spending, that's really the roles where trustees should be doing more, paying more attention. And I think there's even a lot of trustee organizations themselves are raising concerns about that right now.
His other
trustees need to take a more active role in doing the kind of managerial board-level oversight of colleges that they haven't been doing.
And you touched earlier, Goldie, on his other point, you know, administrative staff versus faculty. And when you talk to higher ed professionals, as we have, you know, they say, hey, look, you know, they mentioned some of the factors that you mentioned, all the requirements and all the paperwork and so forth. But how much value do you put, Goldie, in these comparisons that I have seen that do show giant increases in administrative staff versus the faculty? I mean, how much should we look at that askance, and how much should we say, okay, but, you know, the demands have gone up, too, administratively on colleges?
Well, demands have gone up, and those numbers have gone up also. But I point them out, several of them in my book, because, you know, in most cases, the administrative spending has gone up faster than the spending on instruction, in all cases, actually, and in different kinds of institutions more so than others. So it's a problem, and I think universities are only now beginning to look at that. It seemed like for the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of the attention on making college more affordable has been on things like distance education. And that's always sort of seen to be as a way of sort of economizing on the instruction side. I think in the last few years, we're seeing a little more attention to perhaps some economizing on the administrative side. There's a lot more, of course, this costs money to do it. There's a lot of hiring of consultants to come on into colleges and look at the way that they're structured and see if there's ways to, you know, cut down on all these centers and change the spans of control that, you know, administrators have because there are too many administrators. So there's a little bit of attention being paid to that now, but I can't say that's a lot, and I can't say it's that far-reaching at this point.
Well, Gregory, thanks for the call. And I want to let everybody know that all of Goldie's articles and links to her book and to the Chronicle for Higher Education are at our website, nhpr.org. /exchange, nhpr.org/exchange. Again, the guest today is Goldie Blumenstich. She's a longtime writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Her brand new book is called American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Sheila's in Concord. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have one daughter who is in a traditional residential four-year university and another who, after 2 years in a residential college, decided that wasn't for her, and so she's completing her degree online. And I'm wondering if that's what the opinion is about doing that, completing your degree online, or the value of online degrees in general.
Well, it's a great question, Sheila. And before I let you go, so Goldie can answer your question, how's it working out so far?
For the online daughter?
Yeah.
Well, she has just started doing that. This was the first semester that she did it. And she seems to like it. She likes to work. So, she's just turned 21, and she works almost full-time. And on top of that is doing an online course. And next semester she plans to do 2 online courses and reduce her work a little bit, which seems like a lot of work for her. But
yeah.
But she preferred to do that rather than be at a residential college and focus just on attending classes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheila. There's 2 points in here. First of all, a lot of students are working these days and aren't able to do that traditional on-campus four-year degree. But what about distance learning, online learning? You write about this, Goldie, and you say that the evidence is not all positive.
No, although it sounds like Sheila's daughter is actually the kind of person for whom online might be the right approach. It tends to work better for what they call sort of a more experienced student, so not necessarily freshmen, and maybe not necessarily students who are coming out of academic backgrounds where they haven't had as great a preparation. Her daughter sounds like she's the kind of person who is pretty motivated and pretty disciplined and appreciates the flexible schedule, and also is the kind of person who can manage a class that doesn't have as much, perhaps, structure as some of the online classes have. There's about, millions of students are taking online classes right now, some of them for full degrees and some of them just picking up one course here and there. So it's not this rarity anymore that it used to be where, online, what does that mean? it's now becoming a lot more commonplace. I think the broader trend for schools will be something that in the industry they call hybrid classes where students take, maybe they'll watch the lecture online, but then they'll come to class for the discussion group and meet with the professor and take better advantage of use the technology for what the technology is good at, and then use the classroom for what the classroom is good at.
So not dump everything on the technology.
Right. I mean, to me, that seems to be the approach that a lot of people are saying is the one that's the most promising use of online. Of course, if you're not in a position to be able to go to a campus, the online option's pretty good. And it's like everything else, You can't generalize about online in any way you can generalize about is college teaching good. Some teachers are good, some teachers aren't.
Some online works and some online doesn't. For some
right.
students, it sounds like, especially
right.
in the case of Sheila's daughter.
And I think it definitely depends on the student, too. There are some students for whom online is perfect, and there are some students for whom online could really be problematic.
Well, and here's another point related to this that you write about that really jumped out at me, Goldie, from this book. You say there's so much emphasis on what students need to study these days, where students do those studies. You write, though, Goldie, that the most important thing is how students attend college. What do you mean? This is a really important point.
There's been a lot of research out there on this topic, and most recently there's been some polling by the Gallup organization, and they went back and they looked at college graduates over the years to sort of talk about their experience. And what the research found and what Gallup has found was that students who went to college where they had a mentor, a faculty mentor, where their work in class sort of had some relationship to the work in the real world, where they were made to see that, those were the students that seemed to have a better experience in life later on, that they could look back on their college experience and find it more meaningful. So where you go to college may not matter as much as what kind of experience you have at college. Are you at a college that gives you those kinds of faculty-mentor relationships, or even maybe an administrator-mentor, if that's what it takes? Are you in the kinds of courses where now and then your course has some relationship to the real world? A lot of schools are emphasizing service learning, courses that have some impact on the society around them. So I think the research is starting to show that the nature of your college experience, wherever it is, is really what's most important, not so much the prestige of the school that you went to, because as we know, the prestige is not about you, it's about who they admit.
Wow. Well, and so given that profound point that how you attend, that, you know, having someone who cares about you, having someone who's interested in your learning, having someone who can maybe mentor you, you've got that on the one hand, but then you do have more emphasis on, as we said earlier, distance learning. You do have more use of adjuncts who are busy and maybe don't even have offices on campus, so they can't meet with you or mentor you. So you kind of have these two competing trends, Goldie.
It makes it really difficult for students, I think, to make an informed choice about where to go to college, because you want to make sure that you're getting that experience. I mean, frankly, you could probably even get the mentor experience from somebody online with the right teacher. I've talked to students who've taken all online courses, and they talk about how they were, you know, their professors inspired them and supported them along the way. They never met them face-to-face.
Wow.
So it's not impossible, but it does mean you have to – it makes it much harder to find the right school. If you are looking for those kind of criteria, that kind of fit.
Here's an email from Nicholas in Keene, who says he's a professor of history at Keene State College, graduated from Keene State myself, he says, in the late 1990s. Nicholas says one of the important causes of the rise of the cost of higher education is one that doesn't get discussed often enough, the skyrocketing cost of health care. He says faculty salaries have not risen disproportionately, but health care costs for faculty, administration, and staff have. He says it's not just a burden for higher education, a burden for the entire economy. It's a good point, and in a labor-intensive business like higher education, you're going to feel those costs more.
Nicholas is exactly right. Study after study has shown that. That's what's driving up, you know, the cost for faculty salaries are not really going up at a remarkable rate. In many cases, they're staying quite flat. But the cost for the health, for providing health care, which is what employers provide, that has been going up. And P.S., perhaps one of the reasons why there's a lot of schools that are looking at more hiring more adjunct faculty because they don't pay their health care.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can email us like Nicholas did. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And after a short break, Goldie, I want to talk a little bit about efforts to address the college dropout rate. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Goldie Blumenstich. She's senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of the newly published American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. By the way, Goldie's Twitter handle is @GoldieStandard. You can join us now at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. All of Goldie's articles, links about the book are at our website, which is nhpr.org/exchange. And Goldie, let's go right back to our listeners. Lauren's in Nashua. Hi, Lauren. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. I have a question about the difference between the profit and the nonprofit schools. I just finished my degree, my bachelor degree, recently in November from SNU, which is a nonprofit. But I'm also looking at jobs with the colleges because that seems to be the best way to not only continue your education but to get your family members in. Because I have one that just graduated in May from a small private college, and I have one in Florida going to a for-profit school. And so I'm kind of curious about really what the differences are between the profit, nonprofit, and if there are huge differences in their financial aid packages.
Yeah, this is a great question, Lauren. So glad you called, because Goldie, you write about this. And first of all, just remind us, for-profit and nonprofit, a private college, usually in this country, is a nonprofit, right? So let's just clarify that.
State universities, which are also called public universities, private nonprofit universities, Dartmouth, and Southern New Hampshire University, and then for-profit colleges. I think, is there still something called HESR in New Hampshire?
Yes.
I think that is a for-profit. I may be wrong about that. I apologize if I am. For-profit colleges are owned by individuals or corporations, and, you know, they're for-profit. The a share of the revenue that they take in every year goes to the owners, not to the, you know, it doesn't go back into the enterprise. That's the prime difference between the schools. In terms of financial aid, most for-profit colleges do not offer their own financial aid. A few of them are offering, because of the competition right now for students, a few of them are offering sort of more discounts off tuition, so I guess in effect that is a financial aid package, but they don't do it in the same way as public universities and private and nonprofit universities do. So a student at a for-profit college is much more likely to end up having to take out student loans to help pay for the education because the schools themselves don't have a financial aid budget.
And by the way, the for-profit college that used to be called Hesser College here in New Hampshire is Mount Washington College. Do these for-profits, Goldie, generally have a more focused mission than a University of New Hampshire, for example?
Yeah, for the most part, a lot of them are much more career-focused. They'll have narrower degrees, business, IT, a lot of them in healthcare. Almost none of them will have a kind of a curriculum where you could take biology or chemistry or physics or some of the, you know, heavy humanities courses. They're more set up in a kind of a career career focused approach.
And you say their value.
There's one in Florida that is very interested in sort of the entertainment industry. I don't know if that's where your caller's daughter goes.
You say in the book, Goldie, that the value of these for-profit colleges, and I'm quoting you here, is very much in doubt. How come?
Because there's a lot of concern that students are being recruited heavily to these colleges when they're maybe not, they're not the most appropriate places for these students to go, and that their programs are, as I mentioned, kind of expensive. They're often more expensive than what you could get at a public college or even at a community college. They don't offer a great deal of financial aid, so the students end up taking on a lot more debt to go to these colleges. And in some cases, not all cases, but in some cases, the degrees that they offer, the colleges themselves are not that well regarded in the market, and so you get the degree and it's not that clear that people will respect the degree that you get.
And yet you say the recruitment is aggressive, you say even predatory at times, and that a large number of minority students are at these colleges. It doesn't sound like they're getting what they need.
No, that's a national concern. There's a sense that among critics of the for-profit colleges will say that the colleges will recruit students who are sort of, I guess, in the least informed about their educational choices. Maybe students who don't come from families where there's a big college-going culture, and so they don't have the aunts and uncles around or the parents who can inform them about other kinds of choices, and students tend to be perhaps more vulnerable to the kind of advertising that the heavy recruiting that the colleges do. Now, I will say, increasingly, some of the nonprofit colleges are starting to adopt some of the same, not necessarily predatory recruiting, but some of the same aggressive recruiting tactics that the for-profit colleges have used.
It does make me wonder, too. We keep hearing about, the number of college students going down as people have fewer kids. I do wonder, Goldie, if that will, at some point, help people with the college costs. There'll be fewer students, so colleges will have to attract students with, with lower prices and more student aid and so forth. Can you tell I have two kids who are going to be approaching college pretty soon?
you're not in such great luck, however. I mean, right now we're in the period of a little bit of a dip of high school graduates. That's going to go on for the next couple of years, but then it's going to come back. You know, the demographics will change again, and I think by about, I can't remember the numbers right now, in the next 3 or 4 years, the number of high school graduates will start to get back on track again. But what's happening nationally is, you know, our country is changing demographically, and getting back to some of the discussion we had at the beginning of the hour about sort of family incomes, our country generally is not it's not getting richer, at the broadest sense. And so we're going to have more high school students graduating, and they're going to be coming, more of them are going to be coming from families that don't have big incomes. And so the colleges are going to be under more of a strain to provide the financial aid, as will the government.
Or lower the price.
Or lower the price. But as we talked about, it's hard to lower the price. I mean, they could cut their costs, but it's hard to lower the price if you don't have state support, so the money has to come from someplace.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Lauren, thank you for that call. Good luck to your daughters. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email that came in from Robin Goldie, who says, a dropout rate can't be assessed as too high or too low without lots more information about the students and about the institutions. Robin says, for example, a high dropout rate can sometimes simply mean that the admissions criteria are too lax. Robin, it's a great point, and we should talk about the college dropout rate, Goldie.
Yeah, it's a very funny number also. You know, we don't even really know what these numbers are. Nationally, the federal government, there's an official graduation rate for the country, you know, that the federal government uses to calculate. And it's but they count first-time freshmen. So it only counts, it doesn't count students who've started college someplace else and have gone back. It doesn't count, frankly, President Obama would not be counted in the graduation rates at Columbia University because he started at Occidental College. You know, he wouldn't count as a graduate of Occidental. He doesn't count as a graduate of Columbia. So, you know,
he would count as a college dropout?
Well, he would count as he's not a college dropout, but he doesn't count in the graduation statistics of either of those schools.
Very interesting, because he didn't start there.
Because he didn't start at one of the schools, and that's just not how they, officially that's not how those numbers are calculated.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. What was the rest
of
that?
So the point is there are tricky, Robin's right, there are tricky ways to measure this dropout rate, and we're not measuring it the right way. Still, there is a big concern that a lot of kids who start don't finish anywhere. And you talk about some of the efforts to address this college dropout rate. Give us a little bit on that, Goldie. For example, some of those administrators who are often maligned are there specifically to help kids stay in school.
Right. I think the college counselor, the counselors at colleges do a very heroic job in trying to help students. I don't know if some of your listeners may have seen it. I had an op-ed the other day in the New York Times talking a little bit about some of the ideas that I've also mentioned in the book, the use of big data at colleges right now. It's not necessarily always big data. Sometimes it's even small amounts of data. But colleges are starting to do a little bit better job of tracking student behavior. It might seem a little bit creepy, but it's not sort of as invasive as it might sound. But they might track what the attendance patterns are for students at college, at classes, and are they logging into the learning management system that they use to file their homework assignments? And did they even sign up for the right major based on sort of their experience in past courses and their grades? And they're using data analytics right now to sort of do some calculation and flag students who might be on a path to academic trouble and sort of intervene in some cases and address some of these issues. So there are systems right now at a lot of schools where if you stop showing up for class and you stop turning in your homework, a trigger will get sent to your advisor, and your academic advisor will reach out to you with a text or a phone call and say, you know, hey, what's up? Why haven't you been to class? Is there anything that you need? Is there something else that we can help you with? So that's not happening everywhere, but that's starting to happen at hundreds of colleges right now and to varying degrees. And in my book, and I think actually I highlight this as one of the areas that I think is sort of promising for higher education, even though it does have that kind of creepy big brotherish
vibe
to it as well.
Yeah, they're tracking, you know, whether I show up for class and how my grades are doing. On the other hand,
already. That's the interesting thing. They've always been doing that, but what they have now is a way to, you know, analyze it and put it all in one place and make better use of it.
So if Laura skips three classes and doesn't hand in three homework assignments, I don't get the phone call, but maybe at four, that's the tipping point where someone calls me and says, hey, are you okay?
Right, and the problem, of course, is it's somewhat of an inexact science because Laura's skipping three classes and she might still get an A. Goldie's skipping two, and boy, she's in trouble right now.
Well, and it's interesting, too, you know, not just tracking obvious things like, you know, grades and attendance and homework, but also tracking, Goldie, I think you had this in your New York Times piece, you know, whether or not I use my student ID card, I swipe my student ID card, to attend a college-supported function, which sort of measures my level of engagement on campus life. Give us a little more there. That's really interesting.
Right. And then, frankly, it kind of gets back to the point we were talking about earlier about the, you know, how you go to college makes a difference. Since there's a lot of research out there right now about students who are more engaged in their campus life, if they're at a campus, will be more likely to succeed. Some colleges are trying to measure that and track that a little bit and use it as a way to guide students, particularly, as I said, some of these first generation students who don't have, you know, the aunts and uncles and parents around to help them, to tell them you need to join this club and you need to try to get an internship, and you know. So the colleges themselves are assuming a little bit more of this responsibility for students and helping set up systems that would keep them on track for some of these programs.
Let's take another call. And this is Francesca in Barnstead. Hi, Francesca. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Taking my call. I'm an adjunct professor at one community college and a university. And I think it's important to factor into, we're talking about the cost of education, the fact that the business model of education has been to employ adjunct professors for a contract with no benefits, and it's just a salary. It's not salary. It's a contract level of pay, and that does not consider any of the transportation, preparation, and
all the outside time that you put into it. Whereas a college professor, right, Goldie, you know, is paid on salary. So if he or she spends 5 hours preparing for that 1 hour lesson, then, you know, that's covered.
Right. But, yeah, I talk about this a little bit in the book. I'm referring to it in the book as kind of part of the corporatization of higher education. The use of the adjuncts is probably the biggest element of that corporatization. It's a giant issue in higher education right now. I don't know if Francesca's part of these efforts. There are efforts in other states to sort of get adjuncts better rights, you know, little things like having them be able to participate in faculty meetings or have office space and office hours, more extensively even there are efforts to unionize them, adjunct professors, and get them some health care rights. It's happening in some states. You know, Congress had a hearing about this last year, I think it was, and they referred to it kind of as the piecework of higher education, piecework in higher education. My dad had a coat factory, and I know about piecework. That's when people take, you know, one person sews the sleeve and the other person sews the collar. So that's a little bit what's happening in higher education as well.
Well, Francesca, thank you for calling. And here's an email that gets to another big point that I know you talk about in the book. This is Ben in Newmarket, graduated from UNH a year ago. He says, a bit disenfranchised by my college experience. Ben says, your speaker mentioned that it's not the college you go to, but the experience a student has there. I know how easy it is to have a very easy experience at college, one where a student doesn't need to learn much and still receives reasonably good grades. Ben says, based on my experience, students feel entitled to passing, if not good grades, for many reasons, but one of them being because they or their parents are paying so much for them to be here. He says, my brother is currently a sophomore at UNH. My parents are paying for him. And because it costs so much money for him to be there, I don't want anyone to let him off easy. This is a great point. People feel like, jeepers, I'm paying for it. You know, don't give my kid a D-.
Right.
What do you think?
You hear this a lot from faculty members. I mean, you know, and the college vocabulary has changed, too. They talk about the student as the customer. And, you know, I get that in some ways. You know, we all have a higher expectation of customer service these days. And probably when you show up at the registrar's office and the bursar's office to pay your bills, customer service should be treating you like they treat you in the Apple store. But, you know, in the classroom, it probably should be a little bit different. The student doesn't necessarily know what's best. The faculty member probably knows a little bit more about what the course should be and what the level of grade should be. I think Ben's got a point there. I talk in the book a little bit about how people are concerned that education has turned from becoming more of a product than a process. It's hard to explain exactly how that happens, but this is a little piece of that.
Yeah,
the change. It becomes a little bit more of a transaction. I'm coming in. You have to help me. You know, in the end, I'm going to walk out with my diploma, and everyone's going to be happy. But you know, I think there's a little faculty are trying to push back on that a little bit. But you know, when colleges are competing for students, and in many cases, frankly, competing for students who can pay full freight. There's concerns about that.
Yeah, you use the word commodification of higher education, and Ben uses that word 2 in his email. Ben, thank you very much for that. Real quickly, Goldie, you know, with everything we've talked about, you do say you're not entirely pessimistic about the future of higher education. How come?
I'm not entirely pessimistic because I think a lot of these issues are, my book summarizes a lot of them, but a lot of college people know about it, a lot of legislators know about it, a lot of members of Congress know about it, and a lot of families know about it. And I think colleges are just going to not be able to avoid the issues, and they're going to have to address them now. I think now it's, you know, it's sort of put up or shut up time for colleges, and I think they realize that.
Goldie, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Again, that's Goldie Blumenstick. Her book is American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. You can find more information, articles, links on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our interns are Joanna Albertson-Grove and Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.